8 of them, of which the most important to the Australian United States and United Kingdom. That's got New Zealand investment perspective, where taxation is on dividends only. And this regime was essentially created on the understanding of the set of countries and taxation rules basically similar to ours, so that we could assume that there was fair tax being paid if somebody was investing in these countries, whereas in the rest of the world, then effectively we taxed on a realised capital gains basis. Was in fact a much more complicated regime than that. I'll get into what the complexities. It is a very complex regime. The problem that clearly emerged was that people found non-taxable vehicles in various countries, so that the regime became a means of tax avoidance. Within a New Zealand understanding that our tax system rests on the worldwide taxation of New Zealand. Listen to that. While for individual investors, there was not a tax on realised gains on shares. For collective investment vehicles, managed funds, there was a tax on realised gains on New Zealand's equities, New Zealand shares. So again, there was an inconsistency of treatment. And we needed to make progress on this, despite all the controversy surrounding it, because some of these issues are quite important to the context of the Kiwi Saver scheme starting on 1st of April, particularly over taxation of modest income earners, who obviously they're a primary target for the Kiwi Saver scheme. Hard to persuade people to save when you're taxing them more than their marginal rate of tax into a managed fund, when they put the money in the bank. They be taxed at 19.5%. So all those are completely changed as well. So essentially what we've been trying to do, and we will never achieve perfection in this respect in this area because of the complexity of taxing people's income in a huge range of offshore jurisdictions which have many of them very different taxation systems. What we're trying to do is do a number of things. Firstly, obviously remove the elements of overtaxation within the system. Secondly, as best as possible, trying to treat different classes of investor on a roughly comparable basis and remove as far as possible the differences in treatment between different classes of investor. And thirdly, address the fact that the whole grey list regime had in fact lost its rationale, if you like, over the period since it was introduced in the early 1990s. And part element in that is the current regime actually incentivizes people to invest onshore rather than onshore. And that is difficult to justify in the context of the New Zealand economic development. So a very sort of broad background, perhaps I'll just go through. Obviously we've had a range of options put up. We've had the risk rate of return method, which intellectually was the most attractive, I think it's fair to say, because it's quite simple looking. But as often things that look very simple on the face of it become more complex as you get down to the operationalizing of the idea. We had a discussion document out. I think there was a real misunderstanding around some of the proposals within that discussion document. We looked to a means for a share approach that proved to be extraordinarily complex and didn't receive a great deal of favour. And so what we come back to is a quite significantly modified version of the discussion document, which has dealt with some of its criticisms, and which I now hand over to Peter to deal with in some detail.
Well, thank you, Michael. You talked about arriving at the EPC in the middle of the CFC regime. I arrived in this job after the original excitement of the first discussion paper and the excitement and the anxiety that it generated. And what all this is about is the KiwiSaver coming on stream next year. This is about sending a message to average Kiwi investors who want to make provision for their retirement savings that essentially we've got a fair tax regime for these savers. It's important to note that the government actually gives away just over $110 million in revenue through this package. So to that extent, it's a tax break for the retirement savings sector. I think the decisions come into four broad areas. As Michael just mentioned, we are going to remove the disadvantage that are there for low and middle income savers, in particular by taxing everyone at their marginal rate, not the automatic 33 rate that's been the case to date. Secondly, Australia is in effect being exempt from the provisions regarding applying to the greatest countries. That's significant because by our estimate, about 7% of the investment by individuals is in Australia. So this is actually very beneficial in that respect. For people who are investing in one of the so-called greatest countries, the formula we're adopting is, and I hope you've all got the amended version of the press statement, because there's actually an error in here. It talks about the amount of tax being capped at 5%. It's actually the income being capped at 5%.
Yeah.
So it's 5% of the increase in the value of an investment in any 1 year. Tax is about 2% instead. Not the unemployment output again, and the value will be dividend to only 85% of the actual increase in value. So it is a very modest proposal in that respect. I think the fourth point to highlight is that there is a de minimis rule in place in terms of the value of the investment, $50,000 per individual, $100,000 for a company. So that, in effect, by exempting Australia, by applying the de minimis of 50 and 100,000 for individual couples, the category of person who will be caught adverse by this regime is a very limited category indeed. And what it also does is open up, because of the neutralising effect, is open up the attraction of investment in other jurisdictions that are outside the grey list, for instance, and noticeably into Asia. So what we've tried to do, and we have spent more time on this than we've had any other issue this year, is take account of the submissions, recognise the concern that a lot of the individual submitters had about the fact that they had worked hard to build up their portfolios and they heeded the messages about long-term savings. And we didn't want to adversely affect them. We wanted to make sure that there was no discrimination between various types of product, so that decisions about investment are made on the quality of the investment rather than the tax advantages. So it's quite broken there. And really, this package does line up neatly with KiwiSaver. It is aimed to take effect on the 1st of April next year. The intention is to legislate for this in the forthcoming tax bill, so that it's in place at the same time as KiwiSaver is in effect on 1 April 2017.
Can you break it down into how much you gain on the third change and lose on the first two?
Not immediately.
What you can say is that the offshore tax changes, as opposed to the balance in relation to New Zealand equities and the balance in relation to the qualifying sector investment business, the offshore changes are probably roughly neutral.
You mentioned one of the objectives here is to stop the tax avoidance, if you like, through the grey countries and the sophisticated investments. Well, what are the mechanisms that, in your mind, are going to achieve that goal?
Because, putting aside the special treatment of Australian equities, which essentially is recognising that, first of all, there is strong dividend payout in Australia and the tax system encourages that. Secondly, we have the close economic relationship. And thirdly, we've got close relations between the Australian Tax Office and the New Zealand IRD. That makes it much easier to police what is going on, which is not true of any other two jurisdictions in relation to us. Fundamentally, we then tax in terms of the change in value. So let me just run through how that works. Suppose that study you've got $100,000 in an offshore investment. I said a very small percentage of these offshore investors got $100,000 in offshore investment, despite the noise we sometimes get. Well, suppose in the year that has increased in value with accumulated dividends, capital gains, etc., to $110,000. First, we'll take the 85% of the $10,500. That's more than $5,000. So we'll then tax you as if the gain is $5,000. So let's assume that your tax rate is 39% tax for your individual investors. You'll pay $1,950 in tax. The surplus $3,500 is carried forward to next year. But that, of course, may be offset against losses elsewhere. You may, the following year, have a loss. And so then that those things flow through over a period of time. So it's by no means a tax grab in terms of applying a very heavy level of taxation to offshore investment. It's actually, in terms of any reasonable economic estimate, some concessionary ratio.
But don't you make your progress, if you like, when those investment proceeds are brought back into New Zealand? And this will be an inevitable question, but isn't that a de facto capital gains tax when it's returned?
No, I don't think that is a fair comment at all. Don't get on the current regime. Outside the grey list, realised capital gains are taxed. This is not a new element within the system. I'm taxed at 100% of value.
Just to go back to Steve for a minute. We're looking at a very small number of investors who will even be in that category. When you're looking at most individuals, will be certainly well within the de minimis, 100,000 for a couple, depending on how they, if you take the fact that they are more likely to be investing in Australia than elsewhere. Again, we're talking here about a package that's going to benefit the vast majority of people by neutralising a lot of existing tax arrangements and encouraging them to do more, basically.
And don't forget that for the collective investment vehicle investor, there's a clear series of gains through
this. Okay, so your example of some of the 100,000 at the beginning of the year, what if it's still the 100,000 at the end of the year? Do they still get taxed on the 5%?
Well, you're taxed on zero.
There's no gain.
That's right.
So, there's a gain.
So take the perhaps a more realistic example, if you've got 105,000, they'd be taxed on 85% of the 5,000 gain.
And if they go to 95,000, they get a tax credit? Of
yes. Right. Yes, losses. Yes. Yep.
Do you expect this to provide a booster to the New Zealand machine?
I think it provides some modest boost because the removal of the taxation on New Zealand equities for collective investment vehicles, I do not believe it provides a distortionary boost in terms of switching large amounts of money into the New Zealand share market beyond, if one likes, a realistic assessment of the value of those shares. And after all, people sort of raise that sort of bogey in terms of the original proposals. That's to assume a quite irrational sort of behaviour on the part of investors. At the point of realising those shares at some point down the track, they'll start to make a loss if they're not careful. And people aren't silly about this sort of thing.
This foregone revenue, have you factored that in, presumably, already, or is this going to create another hole in your...
There was $100 million already built into the fiscal estimates arising out of the discussion document. The change of particular tax relation to the Australian equities accounts for an additional amount of around about $113 million all told. So all that's been required in this year's budget, because we've built that other in, is the additional $13 million.
Did you come up with a figure of $110 million if you don't know the breakdown, what the elements are going to make up for?
Well, those are the best estimates from IRD. There's clearly some element of estimation within that. It's hard to be absolutely precise, because we don't have necessarily the mass amount of information required to be absolutely precise.
You should have got that anomaly of the 39-cent rate, the 39-cent earners being taxed at 33.
Well, very important.
Did you think about offering that lower?
Yeah, down? Well, you might remember in the original proposal, under qualified collective investment vehicles, the flow-through mechanism was complete. In other words, if there was a QCIV and you were investing in that, and your tax rate was 39, you were taxed at 39, we are capping that at 33 for a very simple and obvious reason. Given that qualified collective investment vehicles are voluntary, in other words, the funds don't have to do this, they can opt to do that, there was a serious risk that they would do one of two things: either split into two vehicles,
one under the current regime, one under the new regime. Or that they wouldn't actually go down the optional route at all, because obviously a good proportion of their investment comes from 39 cents taxpayers. Now, it's just not worth a candle in terms of the overall policy objective for that to happen. We want the funds to opt into QCIB so that we can have remove that overtaxation on more modest income earners. To do that, the price, if you like, is capping the flow through at 33%.
You mentioned, you know, the purpose of this is to remove...
And I said also, just to add to that, that the income threshold under which some of these rules apply for the individual investors is well above the 38,000 to 48,000.
You mentioned you were trying to smooth out the anomalies, but you must have had a bit of a look at what the impact of this is in terms of investment patterns. I mean, for example, do you anticipate more money going into managed funds or outcome?
Well, we anticipate that this will make it easier for managed funds to attract investors. We don't believe that this will lead to a significant switch from individual investors to managed funds, but an increase in managed funds attraction to people who at the moment perhaps aren't saving enough. Because the current regime has had a number of disincentives. We're removing the disincentive around employer contributions, which we know it has. We're now proposing to remove the disincentive around the earnings on the funds, which have been overtaxed. So if you were a $30,000 a year taxpayer, you were doubly disincentivized to be in a work-based superannuation scheme. KiwiSaver coming along, removing those disincentives is quite important. What I think you also see is you will see quite clearly individual investors in particular looking more broadly across the world, whereas currently they tend to chase low-tax vehicles in greatest countries and not looking at the full economic return upon the investment.
I'm just going to make the observation that just as we're talking about removing the distortions in terms of people making an active investment choice, what in effect this also does is remove the distortions that are there at the moment in terms of the choices that are already made. So it's a looking back and a looking forward. And the other point that really does need to be highlighted is that this package does open up the potential for significant exploration of Asian investment opportunities. And I think in terms of the broader economic context, that's important. But really, that's a matter for the fund managers, for the individual investors. It's not a matter for the government to make those calls on people's behalf.
So will the losers really lose money when they just change their investment?
Well, because if they can rearrange their investments, unless they're in some way not that they are locked in. But we're talking here about people who are substantial investors, at least 50,000 individually. That's well above the average investment, who should be in a position to rearrange if they wish to do so. The one area which has been raised, and no doubt will be raised publicly, is if you're in Guinness Peak, which is an unusual New Zealand company, to put it mildly, and that it's a London registered company of New Zealand investors, which is almost a kind of historic company of people who dominate Sir O'Brien, if you like, post BIL. One of the provisions in these proposals, which is not tailored to Guinness Peak, but probably will assist some Guinness Peak investors, is that holdings valued at 2007 acquired before date in 2000, which are $100,000, will be the minimus level. We've actually done some checking, on the Guinness Peak register. And the great majority, as far as we can make up at the moment, are well under the $50,000 de minimis, let alone that $100,000 level. A lot of those Guinness Peak people will be pre-2000 because it's been that kind of company, that kind of investment. It's a very loyal group of people following through in that particular. Not a small parity.
You've got more than 100,000.
This is an important point. One of the issues right for this whole exercise has been about a level of anxiety amongst a lot of investors of quite, I was going to say small or modest levels, but certainly nowhere near 50 or 100,000, about the fact that their well-crafted choices were likely to be second-guessed by this tax arrangement, and secondly, they were going to lose. We've been particularly concerned, and when we had, I think, 800 submissions on the discussion paper, which spoke pretty much in one voice, we've been particularly concerned working our way through to try and devise a regime that recognises what they've done and protects, essentially, their investment. And we've done that certainly, as I say, in respect of Australia, with the mechanism that Michael's just referred to, will, we believe, deal with the substantial majority of the people who are investing in companies like MSP. And at the same time, by opening the door to non-greatest countries, we've also given them other opportunities. So really, in terms of, I go back to the point I made at the beginning, in terms of security for the average couple who are investing, as they think, cautiously and prudently for their retirement, we've sought to provide a fair regime that takes them with us and basically says that we're positive and encouraging of what they're doing rather than trying to care.
But aren't you reinventing the wheel for what you are saying is quite a limited number of people anyway?
No, not at all. I mean, this is an area of significant concern on the discussion document. We think those concerns are exaggerated anyway, because all the information that we have back here is that people didn't understand the capping that was going to be applied around the individual investment in any case. Originally it was 6%, now becomes 5% under these proposals. But it was important, I think, to take account of those concerns, because people do get very worried, particularly if we're talking here very often about people who are already retired, and therefore this is their security that you are talking about.
Is it pressure from the governments of Australia, the greatest countries, or from the non-greatest countries to make these changes, or to not make these changes in the face of the greatest?
And so far, I'm not sure this has been high on the agenda of most offshore governments, they didn't make much of a joke.
Right.
They had other concerns, I think, in more recent times.
With capital gains are both realised and repatriated, let's say you've got £100,000 in Shell shares, then you sell them and you make a profit and you bring the profit back to New Zealand, aren't you paying for capital gains tax?
In some circumstances, yes, it is possible that you would, both under, depending on your arrangements, the current regime and under the new regime. There is, of course, quite a wide range of capital gains tax, less than the current regime as well. It depends on how you're investing, really, for your sort of vehicles you use. So if you hold them directly now, and you hold them shells, you're not holding Royal Dutch, you're passing capital gains tax under the current system. If you're holding shells, then that's right, you will, if you sell them, and instead of buying another offshore set of shares, you move that money onshore, yes, then those gains will be taxable.
In the current regime?
Under the new regime, but not with the current regime. Mm-hmm. If you hold them through a managed fund at present, of course, you'll be paying capital gains tax.
If I could just also mention, there's one loose end that we tied it, which is around the venture capital, a new sort of high-tech company, which is quite often registered in the US rather than New Zealand, even though it's a New Zealand company. We're still working on two ways in which we can address the needs of those companies. The intention is not to subject them to a regime which would in fact destroy the capacity of those kinds of companies to be creative within New Zealand. They're a rather special sort of breed, but we need to take account of their concerns.
So do you have any sort of idea of how many New Zealanders have
parting question, any progress reports on company tax review?
No, we're happily working together.
Working very well on that.
Still looking bold, is it?
Well, there will be some bold options and some less bold options.
Does this impact on your ability to deliver meaningfully on those changes in terms of foregone revenue?
$1 to $1.
And time frame on those changes?
Well, that's still according to the time frame we set out. We're still looking to amend the discussion paper and certain things flowing from that in terms of decisions and any legislative changes that are needed in time for the 2008 date that we originally had in mind. So that's working on piecemeal.
Is this a separate, have you got the back in the house? Certainly have the numbers for the first reading. Taxation legislation complex as this. You work on from there. But my anticipation is we have the numbers just passed.
Which parties have you got?
Well, obviously we have the Labour Party, the Progressive Party, we have United Future, we have New Zealand First, and we probably have Greens support. There's not there. Unfortunately, one of the many problems with Rolls passing is that the Greens don't have the kind of expertise that they previously used to have. So, there's no
tax
on
national
party. No, yes, that is a suicidal move by a government to say that we introduce a tax change and we make this an issue of confidence. And when our feet hit the water, we realise we're more flat. Not a great move. I mean, we work on the basis that we consult with parties and we have support on these matters. Individual investors, not through managed funds.
Individual investors with substantial proposed offshore. Between about 10, it's very hard to get the numbers, but we estimate between 10 and 27.
Just one other question to do with that 33% capping for the QCIB vehicles. Does that take care of most of the issue you were looking at around salary sacrifice?
No, not completely. That's a separate issue.
Just on facts and figures, do you have a number on the number of low-income investors that will benefit by going to the 19.5% rate?
No, we don't, because at the moment there's no true mechanism. I mean, it's almost impossible to tell, because it's taxed at 33 within the vehicle. So at the moment you don't have a breakdown in that respect. And obviously also, there's a bit of a sort of counterfactual almost in here, in that we're hoping that the number of people will be affected will rise in the sense that more people on modest incomes will find it useful to save through collecting investment vehicles.